Good morning, Council. Our next case is A23-0029, Republican Party of Minnesota Respondent versus Nathan Miller et al. Relators, Attorney General Keith Ellison, intervener. Mr. Cardall is here for the appellant, correct?
Yes, thank you.
And then we do not have a brief or, for that reason, an appearance here this morning from the Republican Party of Minnesota, but we have Council Ms. Kimball from the Attorney General's Office on behalf of our intervener.
Yes, sir.
Great. Excellent. Each of you will have 15 minutes for your principal arguments, and counsel for appellant, you'll have 5 minutes rebuttal if you choose to use it. When you start your argument, please state your name and a party you represent for the record. Mr. Cardall, you're eager to go, so we're ready for you.
Well, good morning. May it please the court, my name is Eric Cardall. I represent the appellant, Nathan Miller. And the legal standard in this case is a bit of a high-low game, as the court probably knows. In 211B.02, you have the odd phrasing, knowingly, indirectly, impliedly, false. So knowingly is kind of a high standard, but indirectly and impliedly is kind of a low standard. It's high-low standard. I can read the sentence, that would be easy enough. A person or candidate may not knowingly make, directly or indirectly, a false claim stating or implying that a candidate or ballot question has the support or endorsement of a major political party or party unit or an organization. Then I think the key conclusion of law at Addendum 5, Paragraph 6, complainant established by preponderance of evidence, the respondents violated MnStat 211B.02 by knowingly and falsely implying that Mr. Miller had the support or endorsement of the RPM for the office of SD9 in the general election held on November 8, 2022. So just a little background. The 211B.02 complaint was filed prior to the general election, and so the prima facie violation came down on October 19, 2022. That was during the general election, and so the OAH decision became a campaign issue, and so that, of course, right? During the campaign, you have a statement from the OAH saying that one of the candidates made a false representation. After the election, it was submitted on the record for oral argument. Decision was on December 9, 2022. And then Mr. Miller extraordinarily received 8.5% of the votes on a write-in campaign, which is quite something, right? And so why is that important? Well, when you do a write-in campaign, you have to get to know people personally, because people actually have to write in the name, right? And so it makes sense when you're running a write-in campaign that you make sure that you don't say you're endorsed, because that would encourage people to vote for the Republican. So his he states, this is a quote on page 4 of our brief from Mr. Miller: at every turn, I attempted to make sure people knew what I stood for and that I would not be bowing down to party bosses or accepting lobbyist deals and becoming a career politician. I would talk about term limits, about hypocrisy in our systems, and how bureaucracy grows government and simultaneously stifles liberty. So
Council, can I just organize and frame our discussion this morning a little bit? And first of all, I may have mispronounced your name. Is it Cardall with a... Or
well,
Cardall.
It's Cardall. A family dispute, but Cardall.
Cardall.
Yeah, yeah,
okay.
Thank you.
You have an issue as to whether the statute was ever violated. In fact, right? That's one question. Like, is that a wrong determination that it was violated? You have constitutional issues. And I wanted, for framing, to know, just first of all, are you making a facial challenge to the statute?
No, we didn't in our principal brief.
Okay, so your challenge is only as applied.
Right.
Okay, so we can turn to that. Sounds like the first part of what you're arguing is that there was no implication of support or endorsement by a major political party. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so there we look at the finding of the ALJ and what the evidence was. And what is it? And, it's a deferential standard of review, I would think, about a factual finding about whether there was an actual implication of support or endorsement. Although maybe you can tell me differently what your argument is. Let's focus on that. Leave aside constitutionality. What's lacking in the file to support that determination by the ALJ panel?
Well, the word, using the word endorsement, he never used the word endorsement or support And so it seemed that that's really critical to a finding of a knowingly false claim of support. But then there's the high-low standard, because the high standard is knowingly, the low standard is impliedly, indirectly. And so here it says SD9, Republican Party, on the flyer, for example. And the other thing, too, is important, is that the Republican Party of Minnesota filed this complaint. They're not here, but that you can continue to be a member of the Republican Party, and he was, while he was running a write-in candidate against the Republican primary winner. So it's truthful that he was a member of the Republican Party. He has his own philosophy, and he never said that he was supported or endorsed by the Republican Party of Minnesota, the major political party. And so because he was running a write-in campaign, it would have made any sense, because he was, you have to write in my name in order to vote for him. And so it just seems so in a positive, it seems like a political gotcha. That's what it seems like. And the Republican Party of Minnesota was, representing its candidate against my candidate, and prior to the election filed the complaint to get this ruling. And so the statements that he made were truthful, and he didn't say anything that was knowingly false. And I guess the OH is hanging its hat on impliedly and indirectly, but that doesn't fit the facts here.
That doesn't differ that much from the decision with respect to the DFL. That just saying DFL implies support by the DFL party. And here there's an actual statement of Republican Party. You don't even need to infer the party. It says party right there. And it seems like the DFL case was about, well, DFL means a party. We know that.
Right. And I want a quick note that the statutory analysis that we're talking about that you focused me on, thank you, that wasn't addressed in the intervener's brief. So I'm sort of unopposed. But in a duty of candor, I've had one argument here before when I was unopposed. And I lost. So anyway.
Well, we decided on merits, even if there's not a brief. So we still have to look at the merits.
Yeah, no, I agree. Yep. So anyway, but your point is well taken. So page 11 of the intervener's brief, I thought was well done on this point. And so it describes the Schwickenberg v. Ortman case. And said in that case, the candidate used the term Republican to refer to herself. This is Ortman. The ALJ panel concluded the term Republican does not necessarily mean Republican Party, because the term could also mean a philosophy or member of the party. And so the OAH was hanging on whether use of the word party was there. And so this would be
the
kind of...
That's what was in the flyer here is Republican Party.
Right. That's exactly my point. And so the comeback that we would have is that he was a member of the Republican Party, and that's truthful, and that reflects his different philosophy, and he never claimed to be supported by the Republican Party of Minnesota or the SD9 Republican Party organization. And so, that's...
So isn't there notice here? I mean, I was reading the In the Matter of Ryan. I mean, it's a 1981 Supreme Court case, and that dealt with a hire because it was the gross misdemeanor violation under the 211B. So it's a higher intent or knowledge standard. In the Supreme Court there, it just said DFL. It didn't say DFL endorsed. And the Supreme Court said, well, there wasn't enough evidence of intent. But from here on out, we're putting everybody on notice. Don't do this. Because everybody's on notice now. We will in the next case. And that's a higher level of intent under 0.06, right? So why doesn't that answer it?
No, it's a good point. I mean, it's kind of interesting. Policies have changed a lot. This is 1981. Yeah. And so different fact patterns are coming up. I mean, it's kind of like, I don't know if you saw a former Senator Joe Lieberman's recent piece on the No Labels Party. And he was talking about, like, oh, we're going to have a presidential and vice presidential candidate. They're going to run in all the states, and then we're going to determine who's leading the ticket, a Democrat or Republican, based on polling. And so the idea of the No Labels Party running against the political parties by running a Democrat or Republican would be an example of the new politics. So if you're going to hold Nathan Miller accountable, you're going to have to hold Senator Manchin and former Governor Hogan accountable when they're on the No Labels political party line, because they're going to be saying they're Republicans, they're Democrats.
Yeah, and there's nothing wrong with that. It's adding the party. And I think it's the law here is just saying you're a Republican under 211B is okay.
But you don't
it doesn't imply endorsement. It's adding the word party, you know, SD9 hyphen Republican Party that created this implication here, right?
I guess in the situation of a write-in candidate, I would say that there needs to be an exception because the Republican Party doesn't have a ban on a member of the party running for as a write-in candidate against a Republican primary winner.
I think that's a very compelling argument. My concern is the standard of review hurdle that you have to get over. How do you get over that hurdle? You know, the requirement that we look at the decision of the panel below with deference.
That's a great point. I mean, I think that you know, there's a free speech clause in the First Amendment, and so when you have truthful speech that is being banned by the state of Minnesota, then you have to say the First Amendment as applied applies. And so if I have the speech we're talking about, I'm a write-in candidate, I'm a member of the Republican Party because they don't bash me when I'm a write-in candidate running against a GOP primary winner. Obviously, as applied, that's First Amendment protected speech because it's truthful. So we should be concerned about prohibiting false speech, false political speech, because it can deter and chill truthful speech. But this is actually truthful speech. So that would be the way to overcome the hurdle.
Isn't every person who let's just assume for purposes of the argument, it does imply party endorsement and that's inaccurate. Wouldn't that always be a write-in candidate? I mean, it's always the person who's not the endorsed candidate, right? That's the only person who... Right,
yeah,
in
yeah.
these situations.
Yeah, I think write-in candidates should be able to say I'm running to reform my party. I just think that's part of America and democracy and free speech. I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Okay. And counsel for the intervener.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Janine Kimball, Assistant Attorney General, on behalf of Intervenor, the Minnesota Attorney General. Ensuring the integrity of Minnesota's elections is of utmost importance. And the Minnesota Supreme Court has declared that promoting informed voting is, quote, essential in a free society. In this case, the court should hold that, as applied to Mr. Miller, the statute is constitutional. I was planning to address three issues, the first of which was to clarify that Mr. Miller is bringing only an as-applied challenge that seemed to be established in his argument. So then my first argument will be, issue will be that the proper standard is the verdict standard because the statute does not severely restrict First Amendment activity. And then mostly I'd like to focus on this second issue, which is even if strict scrutiny does apply, the court should conclude that the statute, as applied to Mr. Miller, is constitutional because it is narrowly tailored to protect a compelling government interest. First, this court should apply the verdict standard. Only when a challenged regulation severely restricts the First Amendment must the regulation be drawn narrowly to advance a state interest of compelling importance. Verdict involved a First Amendment challenge to an election law. It was about the mechanisms to get on the ballot. The plaintiff argued that his participation conditioned his participation on a waiver of his First Amendment right and also discriminated against him on the basis of the content of the message. Here, there is no severe burden on the First Amendment because it is false speech in the context of elections. It is therefore similar to the principles that the U.S. Supreme Court discussed in Alvarez, where perjured testimony and false statements to government officials.
Is it really a false statement when the standard is implied? I mean, I see things as sort of being on a spectrum, right? There's knowingly misrepresenting a fact, and then there's maybe negligently misrepresenting a fact. And so I question the propriety of applying Burdick in a situation like this, where we have, I mean, a finding that this was negligently implying rather than a knowing false misrepresentation.
I have a couple responses. Let me grab my notebook real quick. Thank you for the question, Your Honor. So we have two answers. So first, a plain reading of the statute is that knowingly also applies to implied. So knowingly made a statement that implied an endorsement. So that's the first answer. I haven't seen a case that's read in a negligent mens rea or something lower than knowingly. Second, I direct the court's attention to the Schmidt case, which was a Minnesota Supreme Court case from 1979, and that was perhaps may have been the case that Judge Siegel was referring to earlier, the DFL case. And so in that case, I pin site 591, I think, the Minnesota Supreme Court says, DFL would imply to the average voter that the contestee had the endorsement or at the very least the support of the DFL party. And the court held to hold otherwise would render the word imply meaningless. So that, I think, controls this case or controls the question about whether this conduct did violate the statute. I think there's clearly a knowingly mens rea, regardless of whether it's stated or implied. And also the Attorney General also defers to the ALJ, who had the facts in front of the ALJ, to determine whether the statute was violated. I'd also like to direct the court's attention to the Alvarez case. Again, that's the United States Supreme Court case. That's the Stolen Valor Act case. It was a plurality. There was a concurrence. There was a dissent. But I think the concurrence, I think it was Justice Breyer, does a pretty good job of describing how in a case involving false speech, there's something of sort of an intermediate scrutiny and that it really doesn't rise to the level of strict scrutiny. The dissent doesn't really say what standard applies, but said the law passed constitutional muster, so I assume it was something less than strict scrutiny, although it wasn't very clear. So that's I'll turn next to the next point, even under strict scrutiny, that the statute as applied to Mr. Miller is constitutional.
Before we go there, let me just distill a little bit your argument with respect to the standard of review that applies. So I'm going to say I'm not super compelled by the Burdick standard, those mechanics, you know. I mean, in McIntyre, which was anonymous speech, it dealt with like a prohibition against anonymous speech. It basically said, no, we're not governed by those cases that deal with the mechanics like filing deadlines in Anderson or the write-in procedure, which deal with sort of the voters' First Amendment rights, because this is talking about the content, a regulation of pure speech. And so in McIntyre decided just 3 years after Burdick said, applied strict scrutiny, I believe. And so we seem to be more in that realm. But are you saying there's a second reason it doesn't belong in strict scrutiny, and that's because it deals with false speech?
Yes. In fact, let me just find it really quick. The McIntyre case. The very beginning of the case, I assume it was there for a reason. So this is the U.S. Supreme Court McIntyre. The opening paragraph says, there is no suggestion that the text of her message was false, misleading, or libelous. So the argument would be that because this is dealing with the statute that prohibits knowingly false speech, this takes it outside the realm of McIntyre for that reason. I think that was in the first paragraph of that decision.
I think that brings me back to my sort of earlier question. I mean, is the problem here that this is false speech, that he's not a member of the Republican Party? I mean, it just seems to be, there seems to be a fine line there. I thought the problem was that, you know, there was an improper suggestion that there was an endorsement, and that is the problem with the speech. Not that the fact that he has Republican Party next to his name is per se, false speech or libelous speech.
So the issue, as I understand it, is that the statement in a posting where his name appears with the Senate district number - Republican Party is indistinguishable from the Schmidt case, which held by the Minnesota Supreme Court, name - DFL implies DFL endorsement. So yes, the false statement is not about whether he is or isn't a member of the Republican Party. The knowingly false statement is the false implication that he had the endorsement of the Republican Party. Mr. Miller could have said, as some of the cases have suggested, he could have said member of Republican Party. He could have said Republican rather than identifying a party at all. In fact, in some of his briefing and even the argument today, Mr. Miller does seem to suggest he wanted to distance himself from the Republican Party altogether and didn't intend to associate himself with them, but sometimes he says he did. In any event, the statute permits, and it would not be false for him to say member of Republican Party or to say Republican without the additional word party. And in that way, it seems indistinguishable from Schmidt.
And just to be clear, I think, my concern is as to whether the strict scrutiny standard applies because we're talking about libelous speech as opposed to the first issue that I think is being addressed here, which you're not even on the briefs for, whether, the panel appropriately found a violation of the statute.
Sure, Your Honor. Let's pivot then, if that's okay, to the strict scrutiny and how it would...
In the Lannert versus McDonald case, which is a precedential case from our court, doesn't that decide that, in fact, strict scrutiny should be applied?
That isn't... Great question, Your Honor. I don't believe that it does. I think that the court could conclude that strict scrutiny applies, but in that case, it was not litigated. I went back to the briefs, and the respondent basically told the court, we're not really sure if strict scrutiny applies. There might be an argument for a different standard, but here, because it satisfies both, we agree. So it wasn't a litigated question.
Okay. All right. So, thanks.
But in the event that the court applies strict scrutiny to the as-applied challenge, it still survives. Several cases stand for the proposition that the state has a compelling interest in stopping false campaign speech. Lannert, the state has a compelling interest in promoting, quote, informed voting and protecting the political process. McIntyre, we've discussed that already. The state has a special interest during elections in preventing false statements. Doherty, from Minnesota Supreme Court, promoting informed voting is essential in a free society. That was from my intro. And Schmidt, which I've also discussed today, the state has a compelling interest in, quote, protecting the political process. So really, there's no question that the state has a compelling interest in prohibiting false campaign speech. And this is narrowly tailored because it affects knowingly false speech only. It only prohibits what it actually prohibits. It doesn't reach too far. And counter speech is not enough. And I think the best discussion of that is in the Niska case, although unpublished, both parties cited that from this court. The state isn't required to rely on the media to effectuate counter speech in order to fully inform the public. Relator, in their reply brief, argued that a person can simply check a website to verify whether the information is correct. And my response is, if the media isn't enough, which has probably a much wider audience, then it's unclear to me how a website would be enough. And the usefulness of the website depends on two things. It depends on an observer knowing where to look for that information. And second, it requires the observer to think, do I need to look? Is it possible this person is lying to me such that I need to look and check? So, yes.
Counsel, it seems like, and maybe this is part of, well, it seems like the arguments you're making equally go to a facial challenge. I'm trying to figure out where the as-applied challenge departs from the facial challenge. And It seems like one place that it might depart is that this candidate was expressly seeking to have people recognize him as a write-in candidate, not the endorsed candidate. Otherwise, it would undermine his success at the polls. So can you speak to the as-applied nature of the challenge?
Sure. So the Minnesota Supreme Court I'm sorry, I didn't cite this in my brief, the Rue case, R-E-W, said, to your Honor's question about the difference between facial and as-applied, facial and as-applied challenges differ in the showing required to invalidate a statute, not in the underlying substantive standard that applies to each type of challenge. So I do think the argument is very similar for both. Mm-hmm. But in this case, I think the response is very similar to that counter speech from the media is not effective, right? So even though Mr. Miller may have told some people, I'm a member of the Republican Party in response to questions, and maybe it's not clear from the record if he expressly said specifically, quote, I'm not the endorsed candidate, but to the extent that he implied that, someone may see the poster, may see the flyer, may see the Facebook page that it was posted on, may see his campaign website that it was posted on, and not know about the other speech, not have access to or have heard it. And so it wouldn't be an effective counter speech in that situation, Your Honor. I'll just briefly address the associational interests. I discussed that a little bit a moment ago. The statute does not prohibit Mr. Miller from saying he is a Republican. He is a member of the Republican Party. It didn't in any way restrict his ability to associate with the caravan of patriots, which in his opening brief on page 23, he said that was one group he was trying to associate with. He could still attend the rally or event, and he did. He can speak in support of their ideals. And further, the statute preserves the associational rights of the Republican Party that had an interest in making sure that its endorsements were clear.
Do you have a perspective, in light of your role here, as what the meaning of major political party is under the statute? Is it the Republican Party of Minnesota, or is it something else? And take your time there. I'm sorry that you had a little water incident.
It was my fault.
No, that's okay. Because when I look at the definition, it says major political party means a political party that maintains a party organization in the state, et cetera, and then there are various additional things. They have to have had candidates at different levels. So I'm just trying to figure out what is the major political party here?
I don't disagree that definitionally Mr. Miller may be correct. I think the question is, and it goes back to Schmidt, where the Minnesota Supreme Court said, what would the average voter interpret, right? Does the average voter know that the state party is not really the Republican Party, mm-hmm. but it's the Republican Party of Minnesota? And so since the purpose of the statute is to help the voter to be informed without falsehoods, that I think should be relevant. Just in conclusion, we just ask that the court conclude that as applied to Mr. Miller, the statute is constitutional.
Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel. And I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. Mr. Cardall, you have 5 minutes.
Yes, thank you. On the legal standard with respect to the case involving core political speech, typically like in the Leiner v. McDonald case, we think of strict scrutiny applying. One of the challenges, I think, in this case is that, Judge Siegel, your question, some of the questions, like there's concern that now the OH cases are being interpreted, the Attorney General's involved, that we're kind of creating a code of conduct. And would the code sort of like, if we're in law, be acceptable? Like a write-in candidate can't refer to his Republican Party membership when running for office. Or a political party membership when running for office. Come on, that doesn't meet strict scrutiny. And so the idea of
I don't think that's what the ruling by the ALJ panel was here.
That he
could not disclose that he's a member of the Republican Party. In fact, I think it quite clearly said that would have been fine.
Okay, well, you could say, the statute said you can't say when you're a write-in candidate you have Republican Party support, you have Republican Party, you're a Republican Party member, you have Republican Party principles, and you're running to defeat the Republican Party candidate that won the primary because the candidate's bad.
Right. And so, but none of that appeared on the flyer. What appeared on the flyer and the question was, is whether saying Republican Party, you know, DSI and Republican Party implied support and endorsement of that organization.
Well,
not everything else you just said.
Okay, I mean, but why can't a candidate say, writing candidate say, I'm supported by the Republican Party, but I lost the primary. Primaries are low voting events. And so what's wrong with that and the First Amendment? I mean, I think that this idea that we're on this great journey and we're trying to create a code by which write-in candidates can operate under, it just seems like Orwellian.
I think part of the state's interest, though, as articulated by case law, is just to not introduce, I think, confusion to an electorate. And so, I mean, you know, when you're saying long statements of a person's perspective, you know, if that would be a different case. If we're looking at a flyer that said what you just said, we're in a different landscape. But the question is whether creating, I think, confusion as to who's endorsed, who's supported by the party, et cetera, is the issue. I mean, I don't know whether, you know, if the flyer had said endorsed by the Republican Party of Minnesota, would you also think that's a First Amendment problem under the statute?
Well, no, if it's truthful. I mean, if the candidate was endorsed.
No, if it's not. Sorry, if the candidate is not.
Right, but you can be endorsed and lose the primary. And then as an endorsed candidate, you can run in the, mm-hmm. in the, and that happened to a candidate down in Chanhassen. So can you run as a write-in candidate with the endorsement if you lost the primary? And can you say, I was endorsed by the Republican Party? Absolutely.
And what if a candidate was not endorsed and includes that on a flyer? Running as a
right, and let's even say that some of the statements are like half and half, like half kind of true, half kind of not. Well, I don't know. I don't like the procedure. I remember in disorderly conduct cases, the Minnesota appellate courts have said disorderly conduct can't be used by the government to create a code of manners, and I think that's really smart. That we shouldn't have police officers using disorderly conduct as a way to regulate the manners. When people get arrested, like, they can say what they want, basically. And I think here, you know, if you're running as a write-in candidate, you're really mad at your party or you're really mad at the system, yeah, you should be able to say what you want. Now, this issue of, like, was he saying he won the primary? It seems like the candidate's inoculated because it says on the ballot, Republican Party or Democratic Party. I guess
I'm a little confused why we're talking about the primary. I mean, we're looking at a statute that talks about not stating endorsement or support by a major political organization unless you, in fact, have that. So,
right, and the primary way that the state protects the primary winner is it says in the ballot, Republican Party of Minnesota or DFL. Mm-hmm. So isn't that what you win? Do you really win this? The state-imposed code regarding free speech. And I guess I just end that I think with the particularly the application of an attempt to apply a lower legal standard in this case than strict scrutiny, that we're looking at the Attorney General's office and the state treating Minnesota citizens as second-class citizens under the First Amendment. And what I would hope that we'd have a state where Minnesotans are given all their First Amendment rights. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel, for your briefing, for your arguments today. We appreciate them. The case is submitted, and we'll have a decision out in a statutory time period.